I'm looking in a way for the bad news here, or trying to find something to deal with the question of what happens to the native musics. I heard a lot about it in Africa, where musicians in Ghana are out of work partly because of a curfew, but more because the big record companies can put Britney Spears on the air in Ghana at the expense of Ghanaian musicians. And then there's the drum machine. They genuinely worry that the computerized drum is going to kill the drum tradition, where it begins and where it reaches its highest thing. Drummers are out of work.
Playing with the percussionists that we do in with Joe Granley, Mark Suter, Shane Shanahan, Sandeep Das from New Delhi, I have learned more about music from these percussionists in the last 2 years because they are not drum machines, and because what they do is totally alive and there's a feel to it. And Brazilian music, playing with Ciro Batista, and the way he does the motoric rhythm that in where a drum machine would be absolutely, lined up. His beat, 1, 2, 3, 4, 1, 2, 3, 4. It's like the second 16th pops out. It's uneven and it makes you go crazy. It gives you such an unbelievable groove. I'm a terrible dancer. It makes me want to, to go on the floor. I think it's, how do you keep it from being taken over by other things? By having people who believe enough in the expression of a music and who is willing to be generous to teach. Kehan Kalhor, wonderful Kemanche player, lives in Tehran, part of the time in New York. He told me how he teaches. Young kids, he takes them hiking, he takes them on trips, he talks to them about poetry, philosophy, old style teaching. It's like sort of, and so you open up a world that is so inviting and so amazing that if you're looking for something, you're looking for a way of expression, you're at the age where the world is wide open, and this strikes you, my gosh, you commit the next 40 years of your life to trying to explore that thing. And I think each one of these masters has that capacity to excite, because the content is so broad, so deep. What are the great transnational ideas that really are exciting to learn about, would make a 15-year-old want to go and say, I really want to learn this. I want to go into this. You could do this in many, many ways. Wu Tong had this suggestion, which is to say, why don't you look at the 9 great rivers that flow from the Tibetan plateau? That flow into the Ganges, into the Indus, the longest river that goes into Kazakhstan, the Yangtze River, the river that goes into the Mekong. There's a book written about it recently. And why don't you look at it as, and that those rivers provide some of the world's fresh water, all the cultures, the religions. It gives time, space, depth into a way of looking at culture. And now look at what Pete Seeger did with the Hudson River. Find a way to actually say what does go on in the Ganges. They're great stories. I would love to go. And
sounds like a Kim adventure.
Yes, it could be. But it could be a wonderful way to then say, okay, let's look at all the music around it. Let's look at, then you can follow this, history, the world, geography, can all come to life, and we, in the end, have a better understanding of politics if you know all the trials and tribulations of what actually happens along the cradles of civilization of, let's say, a river. That's one thought. That's better than talking about a drum machine, because it's not, you're not talking about this is taking over. Let's talk about some ideas that are really, really powerful, that can actually, if you know that and you can feel empathetically closer to another place and another people, I promise you, we end up making different decisions.
But it's so, learning.
It's all about listening. If you really learn, and the difference is, there's a difference between, and you know this much better than I even, that there's a difference between information and knowledge, right? So when do you turn information into knowledge, and when do you actually internalize knowledge? And when you really internalize knowledge, you could then start to create within that form. So it's an artistic point of view of all of this is you have to understand your own boundaries. You have to be able to have someone take you inside something else. And once you begin to learn that vocabulary, you can participate. You're not a consumer anymore. You're actually really, really closely allied to that other form. Then you come back to your own form much richer for it, because you have better ears.
Will we ever hear a whisper of the influence of this experience in your performances of Haydn or Dvorak?
All the time. Bach? What I learned about groove in the last 6 months, and I just did a whole bunch of gala concerts of concertos, different concertos, Shostakovich, Haydn, Tchaikovsky, whatever. I'm practicing more and more carefully, with more devotion, because I'm saying, have I been as careful with this as before? Have I invested as much of that kind of attention for that kind of groove, which can happen in Haydn or in Tchaikovsky? Because I now hear better. And as a result, I'm playing more relaxed, and I think I'm a better musician.
Listen to some of the groove he's referring to in Tchaikovsky's Rococo Variations for cello and orchestra.
So it's a constantly changing thing, but the important
thing. This is so interesting. Just to go back a few years ago, I was interviewing Seiji Ozawa, and I asked you, what should I ask him? And you probably mischievously said, ask him how music is different after you're 60. And he said, you ask Yo-Yo, how music different after 40? Yeah. And then he said, but he was marveling that same day. He said, you had just finished three or four concerts in a row playing two Haydn concerts. He said, Yo-Yo, fantastic. Yo-Yo, fantastic. He play Haydn different every time. Every time it's different. And it's going to be different the next time, I gather.
I hope so. absolute reproduction for a live musician is death. A lot of people say, well, text music and improvised music, they're such different forms. And I'd like to say that when we try and work together with people who are both traditional musicians and improvisatory musicians, and you have text musicians working together, and suddenly you're either having the improvisatory musicians improvising musicians work with text, or you're having the text musicians go the other way, it becomes the same thing. We're operating then in the same kind of sphere, but with slightly different strengths. So I think that if ultimately it's a question of creativity and ongoing developing creativity, and I believe that the more you learn, the more, I mean, deeply learn, I mean, acquiring knowledge, internalizing, the more creative you can be, because you have more to draw on. And I think the two have to go together.
What light does the cultural and the musical thing shed on the political thing? And I'm thinking very specifically of coming back from Cuba a couple of years ago, and the question in my mind was, how in the world did we ever get into a kind of cultural confrontation with a country where everybody, young, old, lighter shade, darker shade, rich or poor, everybody can dance like Fred Astaire and Ginger Rogers? I mean, they're all sort of spectacular. Even walking down the street, you feel a kind of rumba grace and health and vitality and joy and pleasure in being a human being. And how did this happen?
Well, and the reverence for antique American cars.
Well, they make do with what they have.
Yeah, yeah.
You sound wonderfully unpolitical, but I wonder, are you also thinking about music in a time of world crisis, political crisis? Does that enter into your dreams and your worries?
Well, I think about what my parents went through. My father was born in 1911. He went through, well, obviously World War I in China, the Japanese invasion, civil war in China. He experienced World War II beginnings in China as well as in Paris. So, I mean, a lot of my parents' lives had to do with instability. So I'm an immigrant and to the United States, and I don't take that for granted. I don't take stability for granted. I feel very lucky that, you know, I haven't been involved in any wars and whatever. But I think that World War II did a tremendous amount to destroy the fabric of the music that I play, that I was weaned on. And so I see the effects of war on people and on culture, which is my goal to understand and to always try and move forward. I don't think that's a political act. That's a human act.
How do this tremendous cultural sort of lifelines that are thrown to each other get tangled up in politics so bad?
I don't know, because politics is not something that I, you know, choose to really engage in, because I think the work in culture is a separate frame.
Really?
And I think that because, well, political development certainly in our country has cycles, 4 years, changes, whatever. In the gestation period for a style to become what then, for it to develop and to become known, that is a complete different time frame. It's not a business cycle. It is often longer, it's messier, it's scrappier, it's less transparent. However, I believe that thing that you say, well, how come people do this so well and how come we get tangled up in it? I think that if we knew more of what is really precious to somebody else.
Mm.
And somebody else knows what is precious to you and me. We actually start a different conversation. You have less room, you have fewer misunderstandings.
You've spoken of the Silk Road Project, this wonderful phrase, what happens when strangers meet? And yet we're told now that what happens when strangers meet is we have a clash of civilizations and maybe a good shoot 'em up war. How do we deal with this?
Well, I think that, again, just from the cultural side, the ensemble went to Syria last year. We played in Aleppo for the Aga Khan's architecture prize. So it's for, you know, the architecture prize is given to architecture that is somehow built in the Muslim world, anywhere from Egypt or North Africa to Indonesia. And there are so many ways to express that in music, from the saraband in a Bach suite, which came from Moorish Spain, was a lewd and lascivious dance in the 1400s, then became, now we, you know, it's part of a German piece of music. How did that happen? You show the transnational influences from Bach to Ravel to Azeri music, to Persian music, to Indian music, and suddenly we find that what has flowed in music that and exists in those cultures and that continue to exist show a much greater span of understanding and of tolerance and of the flow of music and ideas than we can presently give in political terms as well as in economic terms. And I think that we're going to Tajikistan, to Kyrgyzstan, and Kazakhstan.
You can go to these places now.
We're definitely going. And not only that, we're going to work with, you know, students there. We actually, just now, through Siemens, brought a wonderful composer from Tashkent, Dmitry Yanov-Yanovsky, and to a Siemens factory in Piscataway, New Jersey, and hearing aid factory. And he just wrote a piece. He was in residence for 2 months and was just performed last night in Piscataway in Hoboken. And people were really wildly excited about it. So he's going to go back, taking the experience of living with the family in New Jersey with the factory, and work with us, work with those memories. And we will also then, when we go to, hopefully we will also go to Uzbekistan, when we go, we will engage with kids, either to play with them, to work, and show what's possible.
We're listening to Yo-Yo Ma making old music new and new music approachable. There's a thought when we come back about rebuilding culture in a time of war. You're listening to The Whole Wide World from PRI, Public Radio International.